The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. We've got apparently a whole bunch of Qs that have been generated by the series of shows we've been doing over on the EDU side about the fun number, but I'm sure we've got a little Social Security thrown in there as well. It's hard to escape that. We get regular questions about such a simple and straightforward program. I'm amazed that people have questions. Sorry, being a little sarcastic today. So I've got Jim with me in the remote studio. He rushed home in order for us to record this, so pardon him if he's out of breath. He had to run in all the way from the car and get set up frantically. And so we might have to give him a minute to recover, but...
It's not that bad, my God.
Well, see, there you go. You're out of breath in the first sentence.
No, I had to cough, so I muted myself. I walked into the house. I did not need to run into the house.
I thought you were more urgent than that.
No. But apparently I've got a very strong heart. Anyways, I came back from my cardiologist today. That's why I was in the office this morning. I'm usually home on Fridays, all day on Fridays. But my first follow-up visit since my ablation... He gave me the rundown. He said when they were in there looking around and doing my second ablation, when they're inside the heart, they saw that all the areas, they do around four veins that they ablated with my first one a year and a half ago, had completely healed. And that's why I was most likely going back into AFib all the time. So they hit it again.
They zapped you extra hard this time?
They did it extra hard, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, but they used cold this time. Remember the first time they were the heat miser. Mm-hmm. Second time around, they were, what are they, Dr. Freeze or something like that? I don't know. But we'll see. Hopefully it will form scar tissue, which apparently is the aim, to form scar tissue and not have your heart heal. He says, you heal very well. You've got a strong heart and you must heal very well. But anyways, that's all that's new with me, folks. So I am not out of breath walking into the house from the car. But Chris is right. I drove home to record from home. So I have things to do this afternoon, so I didn't want to stay in the office. But today we're going to start with Social Security, because we always do on Q&A shows. And then we're just going to pretty much concentrate the Qs on questions pertaining to the series of fun number EDU shows. We have probably one more EDU show to do next week. We will start to talk about sub $1 million portfolios and unique, I don't want to say strategies, but unique planning issues that people with smaller portfolios face when trying to calculate their fund number or trying to retire, period. There's just more decisions that have to be made between the younger them and the older them. That's really what it comes down to. And we'll go over that per some listeners' thoughts when we had used 2.8 million as the hypothetical client. People took that to heart and wanted us to do a hypothetical situation with someone with significantly less than 2.8 million. So that's what we're going to do. I think we can get it done in one show, Chris, but if it takes two, so be it. We'll do it in two shows. But okay. Today, and probably the next Q&A show as well, we'll just do questions dedicated to a concept that we call the fun number, which really is just a part of this whole process that Chris and I call the secure retirement income process of calculating your minimum dignity floor, covering it with lifetime guaranteed secure income, and then, of course, working towards covering aging-related expenses and guaranteed inheritances if that's important to you, and putting a reasonable buffer aside in case things go wrong, and ultimately coming up with the concept we call the fun number, and then trying to spend that and invest it appropriately throughout your go-go, slow-go, and no-go years. And then, of course, invest the remaining assets, which have all been broken up into the concept we call see-through portfolio, in appropriate investments and allocations tied to the risk capacity of all of those spending goals. Because that's what retirement is, folks. It's spending. It's no longer about accumulating. It's about decumulating. It's about spending. And that's what we're trying to teach people. And it's just one approach that we have, rather than doing the tried and true safe withdrawal rate, Monte Carlo probability based statistical analysis on if you can retire or not and how much you can spend and will you run out of money or not. Our thought is, why don't we just kind of dig through the portfolio, assign it to the spending that takes priority, and then the spending that's up to you. It's not rocket science, but it's just a different way of looking at your retirement. Hopefully, those series of shows, Chris, at least showed people that accumulation is truly the easy part. It's not to say people can't use professional help in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. We've said this often, that true financial planning help during those years is, to me, very important. And there's whole firms that specialize in working with people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, and the unique planning strategies of starting a family, paying off college debt, saving for new children, determining disability coverage, determining life insurance needs, of course, trying to optimize retirement savings, not necessarily predicting how much a 20-year-old is going to be able to spend in retirement. That's crazy. But helping them understand the best way to save, what accounts to save in. All of that is important. I personally think you don't need in your 20s, 30s, and 40s professional investment advice. Most of you listening to this have figured that out a long time ago. Passively managed, passively allocated, well-diversified, low-cost, ETF-style investments goes a far way and saves you significantly more money during the accumulation phase. Now, during the distribution phase, some of you will want to keep doing it, but eventually, mostly driven because either A, you got much more important things you'd rather be doing, or B, you start to realize there's a lot more complexity, especially if you embrace ours. One of our questions, I don't know if we'll get to it today, Chris, but one of them was, hey guys, you kind of talked about the good about it. What caveats do you have? What are the not so good ways to look at your approach to retirement? I think one of them would be it is rather complex on the investment side. It's a hell of a lot easier to have just one safe withdrawal rate. The industry average is 4%. One big portfolio. The industry average for retirees is a 60-40 moderate. And limit your withdrawals to 4% of that, adjusted for inflation, and manage one big portfolio with annual or semi-annual, even quarterly rebalancing. It's fairly straightforward and easy. It just, in our opinion, unnecessarily constrains spending on fun during your very limited go-go phase of retirement. So we do tend to favor our approach, which we will admit is probably a little more complex on the investing side. And maybe in retirement, either because of age and you just don't quite understand investing anymore, you just don't want to do it anymore, or from the complexity of our approach of the see-through portfolio with individualized investment goals based on the risk capacity of the spending gets a little more complex. Maybe that's when you might reach out for some professional help. Again, not a shout out to us. We're not accepting clients right now, but just something for you to keep in mind as you guys navigate doing this on your own. There might come a time in the future you might want to pass on or hire additional help with our approach to the fund number. But before we get into any of that stuff, let's get into some Social Security questions. This gentleman is from some state. Don't know which one. So we can't play guess the state. We are getting questions now. We got a lot of questions in this week, mostly tied to the fund number. But people are throwing in hints, Chris, about the state and giving me the answer, which really helps out. So I can test you and make you look like the fool. And then I shout out the answer and I look brilliant. So works perfect.
Yeah, that sounds fair.
Perfect. It does. Works perfect for me. I like it. Okay, this is a one-part question, one-part observation. I'm going to skip his observation to be brief, but here is his question. Dear Chris, so this came in, just so you'll know, October 15th. So he says your most recent show from October 15th. I enjoyed your most recent podcast and had a question about the PIA info you spoke about. PIA, folks, being primary insurance amount. It's really a Social Security benefit that you will receive at your full retirement age. Chris can go deeper in that if he wants. He says, I am 62. I was born in 1960. So the show was very informative for me. Must have been one of your 1960 shows, Chris. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
For people born then? Okay. Does any Social Security earnings and taxes paid from my age 62 year forward impact my future Social Security benefits? You never explicitly said it does not, but you do say my PIA is only based on income before age 62.
Well, what I refer to as the raw PIA,
he does use that word raw. I skipped raw. He just, okay. I said PIA. So yeah. my raw is actually something. Okay, perfect. My raw PIA. See, I was trying to be brief by skipping certain words.
Yeah, and that's not an official Social Security term. That's what I've come up with to try to explain the fact that there's this beginning, or what I call raw PIA, that's determined at age 62. But then the PIA gets adjusted after that for a variety of things, which I'll let you finish his question in case there's more to it. But it'll address what he's asking about as well. And that I call that then the adjusted PIA. Social Security, I think, is confusing in that they keep talking about PIA as if it's just one thing. And it's not really, in my opinion.
So he continues. It seems like it would be a big deal. Let me back up because people might not know what I mean now. His sentence prior said, to repeat, folks, you never explicitly said it does not, but you do say my raw PIA is only based on income before my age 62. Then he continues. It seems like it would be a big deal to the general public if Social Security earnings from age 62 and into future years were not included in future Social Security benefit calculations. Yet I never heard anyone or any publication discuss this topic. To be fair, I never heard anyone before you discuss the donut hole rule that people age 60 and 61 year income is not indexed when calculating PIA. But that is more nuanced detail that only geeks like me would appreciate. I think there's a lot of geeks who listen to this show who appreciate Chris diving into that. Keep up the great shows. He signs his name, but we'll call him George, as we always do. No idea what state he's in, so we will skip the guess the state.
Okay. So longtime listeners know that I have spoken about this before, because this is a common misperception out there that somehow earnings after age 62, even though they withhold Social Security taxes from your paycheck, are a waste. A lot of people think, oh, I'm paying in, it's of no benefit to me. You know, my Social Security benefit was set at 62, etc. That's not true. And it's also not true that any earnings that you have while collecting Social Security have no effect. They actually don't care. When they're looking at your earnings record, they don't care your age, and they don't care whether you're collecting Social Security or not. They're going to reassess your Social Security benefits based on your earnings record after each year that they get the information from your employer that you had earnings that year. Now, where it likely doesn't affect many people over 62 is that, let's say in this case, this person works in the year that they turn 62. That information, payroll information, will go to Social Security. And only if that year's earnings are large enough to replace a lower earnings year in the previous 35 years that they used to calculate your benefit, only then will you see an effect. First of all, if your earnings after age 62 are lower than average for you, it never harms you. So this is, I'll burst the, you know, bubble on another myth out there that if you work and earn just a little bit, say part-time or something, once you're in your 60s, it's somehow going to harm your benefit. No. Once you get to your raw PIA, your benefit, your PIA, can never be reduced due to work after that. So you don't have to worry about that if you want to go do some part-time work or something like that. It's not going to harm you. However, they will look at those earnings, and if maybe in the, where I see this most often is for people that have zeros for some of the entries in their top 35 years of earnings. Maybe they were out of the workforce for a while, raising children, or you know, whatever the reason might be. And therefore, any earnings, even when they're 62, 63, 65, 80 years old, with an extreme example, that any earnings you could put in there that would replace a zero is going to improve your average indexed monthly earnings, which is the interim step before you get to the PIA itself. So yes, is the simple comment about this. Earnings after age 62, and in fact, earnings in any year of your life, starting in the year you turn one, are all considered, but only the top 35 wage inflation adjusted earnings are used in your calculation. And as a reminder from that show, there are no more wage indexed adjustments to your earnings record after the year you turn 60 years old. So as time moves by, those earnings that you earn at 62, 65, 70, the likelihood that they're going to be one of your top 35 diminishes because they are not being indexed for inflation at that point before they consider them in picking out your top 35 years to do the calculation. So he's right. In that show, I likely did not talk about earnings after 62 affecting your adjusted PIA, is what I will call it. So your future adjustments that can be adjusted due to earnings dropping into your earnings record that are favorable, or cost of living adjustments that you get credit for, those things will affect your PIA after your raw is established the year you turn 62. So I think I touched on everything that he put out there.
I would say you did. All righty. The next question, if I can find it, just came in, but it came in through our Social Security website, so I like to try to get those done. And this is a very easy one, so I figured we would do that. And he lives in, oh, okay, I know what that state is. Oh, this is going to be an easy hint. This is too easy of a hint. I wish I could get a better hint than that. But I don't know too much about this state besides my hint. Cheese.
Is this like password? Where it is cheese.
Yes.
That's got to be Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, right. Yeah. Clap, 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 clap. We need a little clap sound effect.
Although the state of California produces more quantity of cheese.
Yeah, but when you hear cheese, you think of Wisconsin.
For sure.
I mean, come on, the Packers and the cheese head and
I get it.
All of that.
Yeah. So from the fine state of Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, yes. Okay, gave his real name, but we will call him George. I will be 65 this March. If I retire at 65, my PIA will be $2,420. Is that including the recent 8.7% COLA? Or will I get 8.7% on top of that PIA number?
As long as he's looking at a current estimate and not an estimate from, say, a year ago, that includes the cost of living adjustment. So the benefit estimate that he's being provided will show, for him being turning 65, so he's 64 now, going to turn 65 in March, that 2420 includes the latest cost of living adjustment because it was in December of this prior year, so a month and a half or so ago, that they updated everything for the then announced 8.7% cost of living adjustment for 2022 that applies to 2023 benefits. So as long as he's looking at a benefit estimate that was generated after that update in December, it's already built in, which is bad news. I'm sure he was hoping it would be 8.7% greater than that, but no, that is that's already baked in there as long as he's looking at a current estimate.
All right, fair enough.
You can tell that. If you ever want to test this, check your benefit estimates in November and then check it again in the end of December every year that rolls by, and you'll notice that it changes by, assuming there's not other things going on like more earnings record changes or something like that, but you'll notice those cost of living adjustments get reflected in the benefit estimate at that point.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get then the next set of questions. There we go. I can't wait till I get my whole new computer set. Although, yeah, I can record in the... No, I can't record in the kitchen where the new computer you're going to get me and the brand new monitor, the big...
Why couldn't you record in the kitchen?
Because I think it would echo and bounce off the walls more because there's no carpet in there.
We can test it.
We'll test it. Alrighty, so we have some questions now, folks, on the fun number. I don't have these in any order. I think one that I would like to begin with, maybe we'll begin with this. It's not really a question, but we can kind of comment a little bit about it, I think, chat a little bit about what she says. But it kind of encapsulates some of what we're trying to do with our approach to retirement planning. And do keep in mind, folks, we say this a lot, I know. But we want people to know this is not the only way to plan and project your retirement. We do believe in the approach we call the fund number, or the secure retirement income process is the name we give the entire process itself. But we do believe in trying to prioritize your minimum dignity floor expenses, covering them with lifetime secure income. You know all that already. We do believe in trying to identify with the remaining dollars how much of those can be comfortably spent on fun discretionary items. We do that by creating what the concept we call the see-through portfolio. And then we invest all those different spending goals. We call them positions in a concept we call positioning. and we invest those all differently based on the timeline to the spending, allowing you to then drill down to the fund number. And Chris and I do personally believe underspending on fun during the go-go years, those last few years of your life that you still have the health, inclination, desire, and ability to do fun things, failure to spend on the things you want to do during that time period, to us, that's as big a failure in retirement as what the media is constantly writing about, and that is outliving your assets. You can start to see the concept and the theory here. If minimum dignity floor is covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income, or covered as closely as possible to it, we know it's never going to be exact. You might have a little too much or a little too little secure income, or a lot too little. That's why you have to review this at least every year and revisit your strategizing. But the whole theory is to cover expenses that are going to last the rest of your life, whether you have money or not, with income that will last the rest of your life. And those expenses would be your minimum dignity floor expenses. Your fun expenses, once we can identify them and extrapolate them and pull them out from your remaining portfolio of liquid and illiquid assets, once we identify those, spending them during the go-go phase to us is what it's all about. It's just our approach. But I think you'll agree, Chris, it's not for everyone. And we just want to make sure people understand that. Okay, so with that little caveat, we did get this nice email. It says, "Hi, Jim, Chris, and sometimes Bob, and the rest of the gang." So that would be Junior Junior and Greg and everyone else. "I want to relate to you how much my husband and I appreciate your series you're doing on the fun number. I am a Fidelian. I'm an attorney. I'm a do-it-yourselfer. Based on what you related in the fun number series, we ran down our own numbers. And I was able to determine we had a fun number that would support my husband buying his dream car now. So I wanted to write and tell you, we are now the proud owners of a Lexus RX 350, and we don't feel the least bit anxious or guilty about owning it. Thank you." And that was it. No name, but I see her name in the email, but we'll call her Georgette. But when I got that, I wanted to kind of read it to everybody and let listeners know. I mean, hopefully, I think Chris and I will begin by saying, hopefully she crunched the numbers accurately and correctly. I would imagine being an attorney and a do-it-yourself investor and a DIYer, retirement planning person as well, I am certain she crunched accurate numbers, but hopefully she did. Hopefully anyone listening to this doesn't rush through the calculations. And it has to begin with minimum dignity floor first. Don't guess what your minimum dignity floor is. Go to good lengths to identify your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. Go back and listen to our series of shows that we've done on the MDF, how we calculate it, things to look for. We did, I think, 5-part series on that about this time last year, Chris, right?
Yeah, and for do-it-yourselfers, probably the trickiest part is building into that budget or that minimum dignity floor things that happen sporadically but are likely to happen throughout your retirement that may not have happened last year in your budget. So you can't just take last year's budget. A lot of people, that's a good starting point. And if last year was typical, that probably captures most. But make sure you build in things for repairs on your home and replacing a washer and dryer every once in a while and paying a deductible for a replacement roof when it gets hailed on. Just stuff that comes up sporadically, but should be covered in the concept of the minimum dignity floor. So that would be my
little
tip.
And we go into that in
there.
Great length in that 5-part series.
Yeah.
The point is, when I read this email, I felt good, but I also want to throw up the cautionary flags to everyone else who's trying to do this. Don't rush the process. Get a good estimate of your minimum dignity floor, a good estimate of your projected secure income, Social Security, pension, income annuities. Look at the difference between the two being your minimum dignity floor expenses and your secure income. Identify the two phases of covering your minimum dignity floor. The period we call the delay phase, that's from retirement until your secure income is fully turned on. For most people, 99% of people listening, that will be age 70 of at least one of the spouses, usually the highest earning spouse. But figure out what the shortage of your minimum dignity floor during the delay period is. You're going to pull, then it's just a net, not even a net present value. It's just what we do. We add up the projected spending shortage in each of those years because we have an ending time period. We know when it ends. It makes the calculation very easy. We just add it up from the results of our retirement planning software. It shows Chris what it is. We actually don't discount. Here's a little tidbit. We don't discount those dollars down. We discount the post-delay period, which I'll get to in a second. The delay period dollars, folks, we just kind of add those together.
Well, and, it depends on how long it is. Depends on how long it is. People with an extended delay period, a 12 or 14-year delay period, that's a little different.
Okay. For most people who don't have one that long, right. Yes. But for the general point, we don't discount those dollars down. We add those dollars together. And the targeted rate of return then truly, well, before I get too deep into it, Chris also inflation adjusts the dollars. That's where I was going with this. Chris from our software adds up every year what they might need in 2023, 4, 5, 6, 7 during this delay period. And the numbers he adds up are the inflation adjusted amounts. So the amount of money you put aside in a perfect world, the amount of money you put aside already is adjusted for inflation. So any earnings you get on top of that are essentially going straight into your real rate of return. Assuming, of course, the inflation adjustments remain remotely accurate, and generally they do, the rate of return you earn on those dollars isn't the nominal. They've already been adjusted for inflation, that reserve. It's the only place in this we do it. I like that approach because it means, Chris, the earnings that you get on top of those dollars. For the most part, we don't discount it down, but Chris is right. If it's very long, we may discount it down. But I like the fact that we use inflation-adjusted dollars there because any earnings we get on those dollars, if we were managing the money, would be in what we call principal-protected risk capacity, which we try to go to great lengths to share with you, does not mean cash. And it doesn't mean low rates of return. And we talked about using CDs. We talked about using MIGAs. We mentioned that right now there's a four-year 6% MIGA, pretty good rate of return. If we're putting already inflation-adjusted dollars in a MIGA that will mature in 4 years and maybe cover the next 3 or 4 years of minimum dignity floor needs, and we're getting 6% on top of inflation-adjusted dollars already, it kind of builds in a little buffer, a little bit of protection in case the delay period is a little tighter than the client estimated it to be. We're only calculating numbers that the client gave us. They may give us inaccurate numbers or something will happen. In a perfect world, there'll actually be leftover dollars in that particular position, the position that we call the delay period position. When it ends when the secure income is fully activated, there may be dollars left over in that position, and that's perfect. And that's why we'd rather have too much than too little. those dollars could then be used and kept right in there for minimum dignity floor, and you could add them. It's up to the client. The client can voluntarily add them to the long-term minimum dignity floor needs, or the client can take them and put them in aging needs if they want, or a guaranteed inheritance, or into their buffer, or just take those dollars and feed it right into the Go-Go Fund. So that's just kind of a unique thing we do. I hadn't mentioned that before. But back to this person's email, the attorney who put together and just bought a new Lexus. Hopefully they categorized and calculated, rather, their minimum dignity floor needs. The post-delay minimum dignity floor, Chris, why don't you explain the kind of the unique way that we do that, but why is that one so much more difficult than the one that I just described to figure out how much money you need?
Well, now we've got an unknown length of time, so your delay period's over, and may or may not have a shortage immediately. Two elements really are contributing to the complexity and solving for how much more you might need to protect that part of the minimum dignity floor, and that's that unknown length of time. We don't know when you're going to pass away. Then also the inflation assumptions between your other secure income, like the Social Security and pension and income annuity, if you have one already, and your minimum dignity floor expenses themselves. If you're doing it the way we do it, your minimum dignity floor is almost guaranteed to be growing faster than the income. So the need, if you will actually increase over time. It's not flat over your lifespan. So that adds some complexity for solving for that second part of how much I might need for that, which we've got to pull that out. We've got to pull out whatever that number is from your liquid assets to embellish your secure income if needed. You might be lucky enough to have plenty, but if it's needed, we take a technique where we actually look at those projections, look at the pace at which that gap is widening, when the gap starts, those types of things, and then get an estimate for what one might need to protect against that situation by actually pulling annuity quotes for income annuities that would behave like the gap where I see that we are seeing behaves. And that's just we found the most defendable way of turning that need into a lump sum amount. And then now we've got the piece that we need to venture towards your fund number.
I confess I was momentarily took my headphones off to look at the iPad to reply to a junior. And did you mention how you look and try to project the growth rate of the shortage?
Oh, I
because
did.
When, you did?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. And that's important, folks. And when you do your calculations, figure that in. By projecting the growth rate of the shortage, that's your own kind of inflation rate that we need of your shortage amount. Not the inflation rate of your overall expenses, but the inflation growth rate of the shortage amount. What does it have to average? Initially, it'll be probably higher than it needs. Later on, it catches up, and maybe even later on, it might be a little bit under if you live long enough. But the idea is to figure out how much will we need today adjusted for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We always round up to the closest one. And I think it's only one insurance company left, New York Life, who actually will allow you to buy a single premium immediate annuity between a 1 and a 10% annual growth rate on the dollars that they pay you. So by getting this kind of inflationary growth rate to your shortage built in, it's one way that you can assure that the money you're putting aside can also keep pace with inflation. It may not do it perfectly. There's no way to do it perfectly because no insurance company anymore offers a single premium or any annuity, whether it's a SPIA or a withdrawal benefit on a VA or an IU indexed annuity. None of them offer growth rates tied to CPI. It's just too risky. But we can hopefully get around it by trying to project what your shortage is. So anyways, as you calculate these numbers to decide if you can go out and buy a Lexus or whatever kind of dream car you want, make sure you're just doing it slowly and accurately. And it, I would wager they did, and I would wager that they backed it all out and they looked at their aging reserves and their guaranteed inheritances and kept backing it all up and came up with what a reasonable fund number is. And that's the aim, because when you get your fund number, to us, we always tell our clients this. We're not going to limit you to a safe, quote unquote, safe spending. We don't want that fund money to last the rest of your life. I don't want you to die with any of it. Money left over is life unlived when it comes to that fund. And we would like or encourage people to spend the lion's share of it, 50, 60, 70, 80% of it. Everybody chooses something different, but spend the lion's share of it during your go-go phase. And we don't know how long the go-go phase will last. If you're in your 50s when you retire, statistically speaking, your go-go phase should last 15 years or more. If you're in your 60s or mid-60s or late 60s, early 70s, your go-go phase may be 10 years, 8 years, 6 years. Nobody knows. And because we don't know, we don't want to unnecessarily constrain you. Again, that whole story I shared of the person who bought the truck and then was going to wait, I can't remember now, I'm thinking off the top of my head, it was either 2 or 3 years, before they were going to buy the trailer that was going to be attached to the truck as they drive around to every national park in the lower 48. That's what they wanted to do. That was their retirement goal. Sat them down and said, you're not going to wait 3 years. Here, let me run this through you again and show you. Buy that now. Get that trailer now and go. I don't know if in 2 or 3 years you're going to be able to go do this. Nobody does. So that's the whole concept. And they took that concept to heart, Chris. And they bought their Lexus RX 350. Is that the SUV Lexus? I don't know.
I think so.
It is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's the SUV or one of the SUV Lexuses. And they went out and bought that, and they feel comfortable with it. And that's the point of the fund number as well, folks. I've always said this on this show for years. When you retire and you stop exchanging your time for money, and now you have plenty of time and you're living off your money, it is going to freak you out. And you're not going to feel comfortable spending. You're not going to know if you can or how long you're going to live or how much you can spend. And you're going to go to the Monte Carlo and you're going to say, well, if I spend this much and if I earn this much and if the correlation with the investments is that much, all these market assumptions that you're going to build into a Monte Carlo that can be changed. Inflation is this, earnings is that, correlation is this, volatility is that. Choose any inputs you want. You can get different probability statistics, all of it based on hypotheticals, and it gives you an idea of how much you can spend every year, and you still don't feel comfortable spending. I saw that constantly. That's why I came up with this fund number concept, to try to make it feel easier. And they shared with us, Chris, they felt comfortable buying the car. They didn't feel anxious and they didn't feel guilty. And that word guilty, folks, is tied most likely. I don't know these people from a hole in the wall, but I'm guessing, Chris, and you can see if you agree or not, what they mean by that. A lot of times people share with me, and I assume with Chris, spending money now makes them sometimes, they may not use the word guilty, but sometimes use the word uncomfortable or unsure. Because they don't know if the older them is going to need it. Mm-hmm. And they feel guilty that like they're robbing the 80, 85-year-old them of something. And that's a horrendous feeling to have. And remember also, folks, part of the reason I came up with this concept is what my dad used to tell me years ago now when he first moved into the retirement community. My dad's getting very old and I can see his aging coming on very quickly, sadly. But years ago, when he first moved into the retirement community, he would share with me, you know this, Chris, I told you about it. The Debbie Downers, they hated when they were in the bingo room and they would play cards or bingo or password. I thought that was cute. Only his generation would play password. Playing those games, they hated when the Debbie Downer walked in the room. And I asked him once, what is a Debbie Downer? What are you guys calling a Debbie Downer? Do you remember who that Debbie Downer was, Chris?
Yeah, they're people that have plenty of money, but are now not able to physically spend it anymore and have a big bag of regrets, you know, big cloud of regrets over them, causing them to be a downer.
Exactly. They can't anymore, usually for a medical reason, they can't anymore do what they always wanted to do. And they're starting to realize they have some extra money. They can see it. Maybe their life expectancy is a lot shorter than they thought it would be, or whatever the case. And they realize, what good did it do them? They could have spent more. That's one of the things you point out all the time, Chris. Mm-hmm. Under most Monte Carlo safe withdrawal rate projections, your advisor might tell you 5, 6, 7, 8 years into retirement, hey, you could spend more.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Maybe you can't.
Till they come up with a time machine, that's oftentimes not helpful. And if anything else, it increases the regret. It's like someone putting it in your face. Well, see, you could have done more. You know, I waited this time to tell you till I was comfortable telling you this. That's one of the challenges with traditional approaches to retirement planning. You leave yourself open to that type of regret. Not that there's a perfect solution that eliminates that possibility, but taking steps to reduce the chance of that, I think, is very worthwhile. And as we've devised and polished and adjusted this process over time, it's always been an eye to that. How can we provide people a number they can, like this person who wrote in, spend from confidently and without negative emotions, right? Feel positive about it and confident that they're making the right decision. And the only way to get to that point is to have the other things that they fear in their retirement addressed in a way that makes them comfortable. Address those, then get to this, what turns out to be the fun number. Now this is spending that you can do now without regrets, without as much worry by any means. Some people are just natural worriers, so I can't say it's going to make everyone worry free, but it addresses the issues directly that tend to bother people in making decisions in retirement. Most of traditional retirement planning does not directly address the issues that truly bother people. It's one of the weaknesses, in my opinion.
Perfect. Now, one thing I do want to mention, because they said they proud owners of the Lexus RX 350, which we think is the SUV version of the Lexus. One thing I do want to point out, because it was from a study that I read not too long ago, and it showed that four out of five retirees shared that the purchase of a car, like in this case, the Lexus RX 350, the enjoyment, because this is all about fun, folks, so it's the enjoyment you get. The enjoyment of purchasing, say, a Lexus RX 350 in retirement and giving it to your favorite podcast host is 10 times greater than giving it to your husband.
Huh.
It was a fascinating study.
That sounds fascinating, yes.
It was fascinating. And the researcher, I can't remember his name, the researcher shared, anecdotally, he thought, but he did share that the pleasure you feel is even 10 times greater if the podcast host's name rhymes with him, Tim, or Kim.
Hmm.
It was fascinating.
I need to start reading some of the publications. You
need to, because you don't read enough.
No, I don't.
Because he also felt if the podcast host name rhymed with miss, kiss, or piss, you didn't have any fun at all giving them a Lexus RX 350. So, fascinating study. Yeah, I don't have it anymore. I can't find it, but I'm sure I could if you need to see it for sure. But just a little tidbit there that I thought was just amazing when I read it not Thanks. Too long ago.
Thanks.
Just wanted to point that out. Okay, this question ties in to this email we just shared. Mm-hmm. So let me read the question and you'll see what I'm getting at. It says, hello, Jim and Chris. He gave his state, but no hint. No hint. Damn it. I don't know much about this state. Oh, I do know. You could be in this state and drive south, or in a part of this state, drive south and hit Canada.
I think that's Michigan.
Michigan, yep, yep. It's right below Detroit, I think, is a little bit of Canada. Mm-hmm. Or near Detroit, somewhere near Detroit. I don't know if it's below Detroit. I think it is below Detroit, is a little bit of Canada. Okay, hello, Jim and Chris. I have learned a lot listening to your podcast and really appreciate your minimum dignity floor and fun number concept. The detailed explanation of this concept over the many, many shows has changed my perspective. My thinking was more in line with a safe withdrawal rate 4% strategy. I am a lifelong saver, possibly to an excessive amount. And approaching retirement, I think I may have a hard time actually getting the nerve to spend my money. I'll pause there. Do we not see that, Chris, a lot?
Totally, totally.
That was a rhetorical question for you to answer. Okay. we do. We see that an awful lot. Not all the time. We sometimes find people who have no problem spending their money. In fact, they spend a little too much in our opinion. But the vast majority of people that work with us over the 20-odd years that I've been doing this have difficulty emotionally spending their money. Again, that whole couple with the trailer. We're going to wait 3 years to buy the damn trailer because they had just dropped 30 or 35K on their Toyota Tacoma. This is years ago, folks, when Tacomas did cost 30 or 35K. That's the issue that we see. Okay, the gentleman continues, Chris. I could see myself reducing spending if the market had a downturn and then waiting for my portfolio to return to where it was before it fell. And I felt comfortable spending again. Considering a market that started in the year 2000, what if that happens when I retire? I would have to wait 5, maybe even more years before I felt comfortable spending beyond my basic living needs. And what about the 2008 crash? I would stop spending again. And pretty soon I could be 10 or more years into retirement and never fully spent on my fun. And my entire go-go years, or close to my entire go-go years, are gone. Let me pause there. So far, he's encapsulating pretty well, Chris, why we came up with this concept. What do you think?
Yeah, I think in combination, the things we do to address the fears in retirement, this is definitely one, right? And it's definitely a natural reaction for people who are, especially when they get kind of used to their portfolio only going up, going down is a horrific feeling. And then it kind of throws all their plans out the window. And the temptation is to do exactly what he said. Let's shut off. Let's hunker down. Let's wait a little bit till things get better. And then we'll continue on our lives. Well,
it's sometimes not the temptation, Chris. It's sometimes what advisors recommend. They all say it.
True. Well, if you're not prepared
in a down market, right? Mm-hmm. Cut spending in a down market. Cut spending, mm-hmm. And that always made me remember the whole Frank Santos, the R-rated mm-hmm. hypnotist story, folks. When I would hear that, well, you just tell your clients in a down market they can cut spending. I used to sit there and think, how the hell are you going to cut food, utilities, trips, fish, housing, and healthcare? You can't. And then I would also sit there and think, you're going to cut spending on fun? What if something bad happens to these people and they don't have enough go-go fun years left to recoup? And they missed it. They lost out. I told you I had a job for 8 years working as a cop where I always met, quote unquote, the other guy. Because we all know the bad stuff's going to happen to the other guy. Well, you're a cop. You're going to work meeting the other guy all the time. It just never made sense to me. Okay, so his question is this, Chris, as he set the stage, and this is for all you listeners. Your methodology is intriguing to me. I think it will allow me to feel free to spend. But my question is whether this has been true with your clients in a similar situation. Does your process actually result in the person spending more over their lifetime compared to a safe withdrawal rate Monte Carlo approach? So let me pause there. Over their lifetime, I don't know, folks, if it's going to result. I don't have enough anecdotal evidence to even look at and to even try to go back and project what they would have had in a unified portfolio, what their initial starting safe withdrawal rate would have been. If they would have spent more than that, if something would have came up and it would have caused them to spend more and the portfolio dropped more, it's impossible to say, does it result in them spending more on fun over their lifetime? But I think what this person's email just shared with us, and the client who went and bought the teardrop trailer a week or two after I sat them down after spending $30,000 or $35,000 on the Toyota Tacoma. And I can tell you that was significant. Those two expenses were significantly more than 4% of their remaining portfolio. I think in the short term, in the go-go phase, it does result, I feel, in at least having the emotional ability to spend more on fun than you would under a typical safe withdrawal rate. Because that 4% safe withdrawal rate, I don't know how much of that 4% needs to go to minimum dignity floor or not. So is there 1% remaining for fun or 2% remaining for fun? I don't know. But I do know when you have a fun budget and you're told you can spend this as fast or as slow as you want, and we're going to encourage you to spend it during your go-go years, which is an arbitrary number. Nobody knows how long it's going to be. So we just tell people, we encourage them, spend it year one, two, three, four. As long as you're here and having fun, go spend it. It's not a one and done. It's not a set it and forget it. And this is a shout out to that attorney who just bought the Lexus RX 350. It's not a set it and forget it, do it once and move on. Reevaluate all the elements above the fund number and make sure they remain accurate and you don't need to put more money towards it. And if you do, that comes from your buffer. Keep that in mind. So I would say, Chris, it has the potential. We have seen this listener just went out and bought, I don't know what an RX 350 goes for, but I'm going to guess 60, 70 grand. They just went out and bought something that is a pretty big expense without feeling anxious and without feeling guilty. I don't know if you could do that with a 4% safe withdrawal rate after taking care of all your other minimum dignity floor expenses. I just would say we see people who work with us spending more initially on fun than they would with a safe withdrawal rate and appreciating the comfort that they feel after doing the whole calculations. But I cannot say they're going to spend more over their lifetime. That I don't know. What do you think, yeah, Chris?
I agree. That's going to be hard. Hard to know. But I am confident saying, just because I've seen it happen time and time again, more spending comfortably. And that's a comment about their emotional status as they're doing the spending. They're more apt to spend. So I do see people do exactly what this, you know, the earlier author of the email when they bought the RX 350. There's all kinds of people that had no intention of doing something. It was maybe a bucket list item. But after we walk through the process, identify that there is room in the fund number for them to do some of those things, they go out and do them. That's money that they wouldn't have spent. They never would have gotten to the comfort level, or they would have gotten to the comfort level too late to actually do the bucket list item. Probably not buying a brand new Lexus RX 350 when you're 85, when you may or may not even be driving anymore. But at 65, that's a whole different story. That's a whole different story. So to quantify it as a lifetime of spending, and our process, I will admit, is not designed to maximize as the number one priority fund spending over your lifetime. It's really designed to focus on maximizing your spending comfortably during the go-go period. I will admit that. That's kind of where the focus is with all the efforts of trying to build structure around it so that you can confidently spend into your go-go period specifically. But we aren't at no time have we sat around saying, hey, what adjustments could we make that might eke out a little bit more over a lifetime? That's never been part of a conversation here in this office. So we're not trying to do it and not focused on that, admittedly.
Right. And we often say our approach is not for people who also want to die with the biggest amount of money left over, because we're going to encourage you with our approach to spend heavily on fun during your go-go phase. And those are all dollars that could have been accruing and accumulating and be left to someone else. So if maximizing your inheritance at death, to be on your deathbed, and I guess the very last thing you see is the balance of your Schwab account before you pass into the Never Never Land. If that's truly what you want, yeah, then our approach isn't for you, because we want you to feel comfortable. We want you to spend on fun. So again, I thought it was an interesting question. It kind of tied into to what that listener wrote, in the sense, I don't know if she's going to end up spending, her and her husband, more on fun over their lifespan than they would have under the Monte Carlo probability-based safe withdrawal rate approach to retirement. But I do feel they spend more on fun during the initial phase, the initial go-go phase of retirement, which to Chris and I is the aim of our entire process. Do you have time for one more? Because this one's really going to have to be answered by you, not me.
Yeah, we can do one more.
How do we do it? Okay.
Sure.
This one, it's not nearly as complicated. I read it the first time, I was like, huh? But when I read it again, I was like, oh, that's not that complicated. And she's really asking how to figure out during the delay period of their MDF, how to figure out how much money to reserve, because they're trying to figure out their fund number, but they don't know how to figure out how much to put in the delay period. I 99% sure that's what she's asking. Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Oh, she gives the hint. She is from the Keystone State.
I've heard of that one.
I have too, but I didn't know it.
Boy.
No Googling.
Delaware? I feel it's east somewhere.
She claims it's Pennsylvania.
Mm. Ah, close.
The Keystone State. I have no idea why they
That's
call
the right
it Keystone.
General vicinity.
you're close. Yeah. I don't think Delaware and Pennsylvania touch, though.
But everything that back there is close compared
yeah, they're
to
all
Western.
Close, yeah. Okay. Anyways, hello from the Keystone State. Pennsylvania. Okay, thanks for the hint, folks, and thanks for stumping Chris.
Yeah.
All righty. How do you maximize the amount to save for fun when guaranteed secure income is going to change several times in my retirement? She goes on to say, Chris, I have a FERS pension that will begin at 52. I had to read this a few times. Mm-hmm. I believe she's retiring at 52.
Okay.
So let's just assume, as you jot some of this down, mm-hmm. she's going to retire at 52. She worked in law enforcement for the feds, mm-hmm. and she has a FERS pension. This pension includes additional monies for me mm-hmm. until 62.
Yeah, the supplemental.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Then it drops.
Yep.
But during that period, I will have a military pension starting at 57. And then I'm going to turn my Social Security on at 67. And at that age, it will be my highest period for guaranteed income.
Mm-hmm.
when I have my FERS, military, and Social Security all running. So then she goes on and explains she essentially has three different phases. So she asks, I'm wondering, how do I account for this fluctuating guaranteed income to determine my secure income needs and my minimum dignity floor so I can maximize my fund spending? How do I determine what to reserve? Thank you for all you do. She gives her real name, but we will call her Georgette. This is interesting. It's very easy with the software we use, but I thought maybe you can kind of help her out how, because you've seen this. We see this all the time, folks.
Yep.
Varying secure income, up, down, up again, all through the delay period.
Right.
I do believe, folks, she's going to retire at 52 and she's going to turn Social Security on at 67. But unlike most people, she has two pensions that are going to come on during that time period, and a special little mini pension between 52 and 62. Okay,
yep.
Chris, help this gentleman, gentlewoman out.
So this, I think I can simplify it for her, where she can absolutely do what we do, which is we need to identify when we would propose or look for the need for additional secure income. We do not, let me repeat, we do not look for reasons to generate secure income in the delay period. Why? Because in our eyes, the benefit of secure income is for longevity protection. If that's the case, we need to be looking at the long end of the retirement. We define it as the post-delay period. Once all the secure income is at its maximum for the rest of the time, without any reductions and things happening, you know, from that point forward, that's the post-delay period, and that's the period where we then step back and say, do they have enough? And I suspect between FERS, military, and Social Security, she probably does have enough, is my suspicion. I don't know the amounts, so that's just a guess. I could be wrong. But we would step back for any case, even if you don't have all these things, if it's just the Social Security, and we'd step back and say, well, this is as good as it's going to get. All the Social Security is turned on. She identified 67. We might look at it at 70 or something, but whatever date that is, this is as good as it gets. Does it cover the minimum dignity floor then for life under the projections? If the answer is no, then we go through a process of solving how much do we need to reserve so that that 67 or 70-year-old or 80-year-old, if that's when the shortage appears, will have the ability to generate more secure income. But that's the post-delay period. In the delay period, up until for her, I would define hers until age 67. What are the needs there? Well, we're not going to solve any needs, any shortages during that period with income. We're simply going to budget for those. We're going to look at all the years between 52 and 67 and look at each and every year, how much is, or do we expect the minimum dignity floor to be, how much income is coming in. It'll start out as just the FERS plus the FERS supplement at first. Then when she hits 57, the military pension kicks in. 5 years later at 62, the supplemental FERS drops off. Then 5 years after that, the Social Security kicks in. So she's got this variable amount of income that's available to cover minimum dignity floor expenses during the delay period. So in each one of those years, we'll look at, there's about 15 years there, we'd look at individually and then figure out how much do we need to take from her liquid assets to fill in any shortages. In some of those years, it might fully cover the minimum dignity floor. Maybe between the FERS supplement, and the military, once it's turned on from 57 to 62, it's fully covered. But then there's a bit of a shortage from 62 to 67 until the Social Security kicks back in. Things like that. I don't know her specific circumstances, but we'd look at it on a yearly basis through that entire delay period and determine from that how much is needed not to to get from income, but just simply through withdrawals from your assets. That's how we would attack this. And that, hopefully with that clarity, it's fine to cover minimum dignity floor expenses with distributions. I mean, we talk so much about using secure income. It's fine to cover it in the delay period, where we propose you switch and rely primarily or solely on secure income to cover the minimum dignity floor is for the long run. And that long run can be any date you define. We use it, we look at it, start looking at it at the point of the delay period being over. But honestly, you could fund from distributions for a few years even beyond that if you wanted to use, you know, more arbitrary date or something. Even if there's a shortage at age 70 in the coverage of your minimum dignity floor, you could still be covering that with distributions. You just don't want to plan, if you're following our approach, to do that indefinitely. At some point, we want you to switch to reliance upon secure income for the long haul so that you can remove from the minimum dignity floor coverage itself the longevity risk of outliving your assets. That's how we approach it. And that's how we do it. Our software makes it pretty easy to do what I walked you through, but you could do your own unique circumstances just in a little Excel spreadsheet. Just need to do some estimating for your expenses. You probably have a good handle on what those income levels will be during that period. The difference between the two, there's your shortage. And those are the distributions you've got to plan for during that 15-year period.
Right. And then you add them all up. Again, we add up the inflation-adjusted numbers. So you add up those shortages, which, again, are reflecting expenses that every year are being increased for inflation, as well as your secure income that would be increased for cost of living adjustments, especially on your FERS pension and Social Security. And military pension, I believe, has an adjustment as well. And we just kind of subtract the two, and it gives us the shortage every year. Add those together, and that's the amount of money you need to subtract out of your big portfolio as you're trying to figure out your fund number. That's you're starting the see-through portfolio. You're going to subtract whatever the net result of that comes to from 52 to 67. You got 15 years. You're going to subtract that money out of your big portfolio. And that brings you to the next step, which would be your post-delay period, which I agree with Chris. You might not have a shortage at that point with a military FERS and Social Security pension, but we don't know. So if there is a shortage, you figure out what that is and subtract that out as well. And that brings you on your way to then determining the shortage for aging, guaranteed inheritance, buffer reserve, any other expense that falls into a category that you specifically don't want to waste the dollars on fun, and then it leaves your fun number. And that's how you would do it. It's not nearly as difficult as it seems. It's with the software, it makes it very easy, but you could create a spreadsheet that would do the same calculations for you. And that's how we would do it. And anyways, I thought that was a good question. Because we do see people like this all the time with varying rates of income in their delay period until their final secure income is fully turned on.
Yeah,
and in her case, she's going to 67.
Yeah, we run across a lot of people that'll have deferred comp payouts for 5 to 10 years after retirement, but then that stops. Well, those sometimes are substantial enough. They're easily going to cover the minimum dignity floor during
and some
that period. And some fun in a lot of cases, but then they suddenly stop. And then there's some need for a while before the Social Security kicks back in later on, something like that. This is all adaptable to your specific circumstances. I think the core thing that happens with all cases is this separation of the delay period, dealing with that with budgeted distributions, and then the post-delay period planning for that with an eye to secure income for coverage instead for that longevity protection.
Perfect.
Okay.
All righty. Well, I think that about covers everything on this show. I do want to give one shout out in case a regulator ever listens to this, which they do occasionally if we're examined. I was joking about the study, if anyone couldn't pick that up on. You do not have to buy a podcast host whose name rhymes with him, Tim, or
anyone
Kim.
Who takes that seriously should probably stop listening to the show.
But I am serious. Buying anything for someone whose name rhymes with Miss Kiss or Piss is not nearly as fun with him.
Not
Tim
nearly as
Kim.
Satisfying. Okay.
Well, alrighty.
With that, thanks everybody for sending in your questions. We'll get to another batch of them. I'm sure there's plenty more about the fun number and our approach to that idea. So we've got probably at least one more Q&A show with these on there. If you want to send in a question still to get in on the fun, no pun intended, just email jim@jimhelps.com. Make sure in the subject line you put phone number, podcast questions, something like that, that will catch his eye, and we'll see if we can't get you an answer as we're kind of wrapping up the this phone number series that we're doing. It kind of has infected both the EDU show and the Q&A show. So if this is not something you're real interested in, I apologize. We'll be moving on to something else in the not too distant future. But this is a key component to our approach, so it deserves a fair amount of attention. And thus we're giving it here at the beginning of 2023.
So. Excellent. And I will say, as kind of a lead-in, I've already decided what our next few EDU shows will be, folks. And it's something I wanted to do for a while, and I think it'll be kind of cute and fun. I'm going to go through all 20 questions on my latest Ed Slot exam. I will ask the question, Chris will try to answer, and then the two of us will share why the answer is what it is. We have to take a little exam, a 20-question exam every 6 months. Hmm. And I was late on mine, so I got a nasty gram. So,
but did you
I did
pass?
It. Yes, I did. Oh. So I did it the other night and passed, but I took a screenshot of all the questions. They're all multiple choice. It's fairly straightforward. But I thought that would be pretty neat because we can dive deeper into the questions.
Well, it'll be fun for our listeners, too, to see if they know the answers.
They know the answers, yeah. So we'll break it down into two shows, 10 questions on each show. So anyways, I thought that would be pretty cool. So that is coming once we wrap up the fund number, and it will be sub $1 million portfolios on the next EDU.
Okay, sounds good. Everybody take care, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.